Good afternoon, and this is Mick Gray from KSJS. We're talking with Mick Ronson and Ian Hunter of the Hunter Ronson Band. Is that what you're calling it these days?
Yeah.
It's been a long time since you've been in town. Where have you been in the last, let's bring it down to the last 3 years. What's the big projects you've been working on? How about you first, Mick?
Well, I was back in England for a while. I was in England, back in England from like 1984 till last year. I came back and I was working, while I was in England, I was working in Italy, France, Switzerland. And last year when I came back, I went down to Nashville. I was producing a record down in Nashville. Waylon Jennings, drummer. And I had a hit record down there. And beginning of this year, we started another one. And
was that for yourself?
No, it's for this other guy. Yeah, this guy called David Lynn Jones.
Oh, okay.
And then I've been, you know, talking to him, and I think it was around May time or something. Ian was coming up to Canada, and over the past few years, I really didn't want to play the guitar, you know. And then I just, since I got back from England, I kind of really wanted to start playing, you know, playing the guitar again. So Ian was coming up to Canada to do 9 or 10 dates, and he says, "Well, you know," he says, "if you want to come along and do them, you know." So I was dying to get up there and play again, you know. So we did that, and then shows started to turn out real good. So we decided that we started off with like one date in August, you know. We said, like, well, we'll go back and we'll play like one date in August, and then from one date it went to like, well, maybe like 4 or 5 dates, and then it went to like 2 weeks, and then it went to like a month. And it's in, and now it's like 9 weeks we're going to be out, you know. But you know, it's real good. I'm really enjoying myself. I'm really enjoying playing the guitar again. I never thought I would, you know. You know, there's a lot of new material, and the shows are going really good. So that kind of, pretty much in a nutshell, sort of says where I've been for the past 4 years.
It's good to hear that you're back into guitar, because I've always thought of you as definitely one of my guitar idols over the years, and it's good to hear that you're into it. Ian, now, I know both of you have been doing producing. Have you been producing anybody as of lately, or was that just, you know, 5-6 years ago?
I try not to.
You're not really.
I'm not into it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll do it.
Well, what about
if something came through the door that was unique? But like, we always get along with these people who can't play, and you know.
You produced a Generation X album a long time ago, didn't you?
Yeah. I couldn't play.
You didn't get along with Billy Idol and the boys, or?
I got on with them great.
Yeah.
Billy now is extremely good. I think Billy is one of the better people around. I mean, he really has taken it on a little bit further. But then, I mean, Billy couldn't sing that well. He was sharp all the time, and he had to sing Tony James's lyrics. And Tony insisted on, like, every word of every lyric being phonetically correct. And, you know, Billy couldn't handle it. So I had a drummer on the bottom end that had a problem, you know, and then I had Billy on the top end that had a problem. But we did it, you know. They were nice guys. I didn't have a problem with people.
Oh, you guys were involved with Ellen Foley pretty much, too. I guess you did some singing backup on it, I think, and then you actually produced, too, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, we co-produced that.
Co-produced, yeah.
That sold a lot of records.
She's good.
That was quite a big record. It was like one of the biggest records Holland had ever had, for some strange reason.
Yeah.
We would get these like ridiculous checks from Holland.
I was just in Amsterdam a while ago, and yeah, still playing it.
Yeah.
She had this huge number one there, like we belong to the night, and like, so we sort of said to CBS in America, "Oh, why you put that out?" I mean, it's like sold a quarter of a million, you know. I mean, it's a number one. I know it's Holland, it's not America, but I mean, it looks like, I mean, people like it.
Yeah, it's only 300,000 in Holland.
So then they put out this thing. It was horrible, wasn't it? It was like, what becomes of the broken hearted type song? It was horrible.
You guys, now, in the early days, I mean, this is a long time ago, but it really is history. I mean, you guys were involved with David Bowie in the early days. I know, I mean, gosh, the, the things you did with that music back then. I mean, I think Man Who Sold the World and Ziggy Stardust are really classic albums. How did you guys originally get involved with him? I mean, you were probably first, huh?
Yeah, I was involved with him for quite a long time, you know, and then David, you know, took a real interest in Motley Hoople, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing, and then that's how come I met Ian, you know, for you know, working with David, and then David was working with Motley Hoople, you know, and I used to go to the studio.
Yeah.
You know, we used to start hanging out and stuff, you know.
I got on well with Mick, you know.
Yeah.
Just seemed to get on well with Mick or something. David was kind of a different kettle of fish, yeah. You know, but we always got on really well.
Yeah.
I got on all right with David, but he's inclined to change his colours like a chameleon, you know.
Mm.
Mick was kind of like more of the same background as me, and we were working class lads. And
Mick, you recorded your solo albums with a lot of the members of, like, that were involved with pinups and things like that. Like, yeah. Easley Dunbar were in there. And,
sure.
Yeah.
Well, that was like... That was basically the band. We just changed the drummer.
Yeah, know? Okay.
Yeah.
Made
a lot of stuff going down on the road. And,
now,
I worked with Ainsley too.
Great drummer, huh? Fantastic.
Great drummer.
Yeah.
Now David wrote, supposedly, the story goes, he wrote all the young dudes for you. I've heard rumors that said that you were interested in Suffragette City or Drive-In Saturday Night or something like that.
The truth of it was, he offered us Suffragette City, and I turned it down.
Yeah,
it wasn't strong enough. And it was a good song, but
Right. Mott
had like three missed singles already, and so the radio was shut. And when the radio's that shut to you, you need something not far short of a classic to open the door again, you know. And Suffragette wasn't it. Then he offered us Dudes, and I think you had tried it, didn't you? You had been playing it, trying to play it or something. For some reason, he offered it us. And then I wanted Driving. I can't imagine why I wanted Driving Saturday, but we had Dudes. And then he played me Driving Saturday. He had John Amoni dancing on Driving Saturday. He played me them, right? It was obvious that he was going to do John Amoni dancing, and we weren't, you know. But then I liked Driving Saturday for some reason. I had this all worked out. We were going to do it.
Uh-huh.
And I tried to get Driving Saturday off him, but he wouldn't budge, right? By this time, I think he was slightly miffed. He'd given us Dudes, you know. So we then had to go and, you know, write our own. But one of the things we had learned from Mick and David was the work effort was a lot higher than we thought it was. We thought, like, from live, we just went in the studio, did it the same way.
Yeah.
We were a heavy band live, so... But then when we watched them work, we figured this ain't as easy as we thought it was. So by the time we'd split with David and Mick, we had a pretty good idea what we were doing in the studio too.
Now, you joined... Were you actually a member of Mott at the end? Did you record in the studio or just live stuff?
We only recorded one song in the studio. It was Saturday Gigs.
It was great.
Okay.
We did nothing. It was great.
And
did you tour with Mott also?
Yeah, for like 3 weeks.
Okay.
They didn't like him. They all hated him. They were jealous of him or something. Well, what happened was me and him got together. And all I was trying to do was... get him in the band quick so he felt comfortable so he could function, you know, because we never had any time in them days, you know. It was like and the press was all over us, and it was like, well, the first gig that we were gonna, you know, I mean, if it wasn't quite right, and then it would have been all a joke. They're a joke, you know what I mean? They were just waiting. We were set up. So I was really trying, we went to Europe out of the way to do this European tour, and we were just trying to make him feel comfortable. But I noticed every morning, like when we'd be having breakfast and all that, My band would be sitting like as far as they could get, you know.
Yeah.
And after about 3 days of this, suddenly it dawned on me what was going on, you know. Now, we were like 28, 29, 30 or something. We weren't babies. And I just thought that was infantile, you know.
Yeah.
And they didn't like it when we went on Top of the Pops, you know.
Well, there was more of him. There was a big row because they were showing him more than they were showing the drummer and all that infantile bullshit, you know. Who cares, you know? I mean, the thing is, you're on Top of the Pops, so it's going to be a hit, you know what I mean?
What about all those guys from the Mott days? How about like Ariel Bender? What was his real name? Is Luther Grossenberg? Groffner. Yeah, Groffner. Whatever happened to him? I haven't heard from him in years.
You Americans have got a different way of saying everything. Luther Grosvenor, right?
Yeah, there you go.
I bet you say Leicester as well, right?
What's that word?
Leicester.
Leicester?
Mm-hmm. Or Worcester.
Oh, yeah, Worcester. Worcester.
That's beside the point.
Anyways,
no, that's actually Worcester.
Is it?
Worcester. Yeah, you don't say Worcester.
No, no.
You say Worcester.
Got it. I am at a minority here. I can't fight for my American.
Well, it's spelled that way, so you're right. Yeah, but I mean, right. For some strange reason, we just don't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, ex-members of Mott, like Ariel Bender, was one of the ones that really hit me off as being pretty exciting at the day. Whatever happened to him?
Well, he was exciting, but he wasn't creative. He was pretty creative in Spooky Tooth, but when he came with us, he just didn't match us. You know, he's one of the best friends I've ever had in my life. Great guy to have in a band, but we weren't going anywhere, and I didn't have that partner. Like with McRalph, I had a guy who would, like, I go too far on my own, and you need a guy there going like, that was fucking stupid, that's over the top, you know. Mm-hmm. And you need a co-writer, and you need people to kick off, you know.
Yeah.
Luther couldn't do that. Luther was like, he's kind of like Earl Slick, you know, like, what you want me to do, I'll do it,
okay.
You know, that kind of a deal.
Yeah.
So the band slipped, not media-wise or crowd-wise, but it was slipping really badly. And Mick could have saved its bacon, but it was gone, you know. I mean, one reason or another, it was gone.
How about other members of Mott? What are they doing these
Buff's
days?
The drummer's a producer for the BBC. The bass player owns two antique stores and goes fishing all the time, and that's somebody else run the antique stores for him. The organ player's in a halfway house. He's not very well. He never was very well. He's probably happier now than he ever was. There was a lot of craziness in that band.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was... I don't think I really had much to do with that craziness.
Yeah.
And that can be good in a band, you know. I'm not saying that was a bad thing, but at the end, I was doing the interviews. I was doing everything. I was writing all the songs, and I was getting like a real snidey attitude from them, and I got like real sick with it. So that was that.
Did you know that Joe Elliott of Def Leppard claims Mott the Hoople is his favorite all-time band?
Oh, Joe brings me up all the time. He got up with us in Toronto. He loves us. He can't get enough of it. He'll get up and back and sing all night long if you let him.
That's great. That's great. What about okay? Now you do say that there is an album that you guys are wanting to record.
Yeah.
And you're searching for a label at the moment.
We're not searching. There's plenty of labels.
They'll find
three
you.
Or four of them. It's just a question of there's two particular labels that we're interested in going with. We hope they're going to coincide. It's not only the label that wants you know, it's the label you want.
True.
I've been ripped off twice by labels, aesthetically, and I don't want it to happen again, because we're a little on the, he's not starving, I'm not starving, we don't really have to do this anymore. Yeah. We're only coming this time around for the right reasons, you know.
Right.
So why go and, we've been offered I was offered two solo deals last summer. It's not a question of that, it's a question of somebody walking in there and being like totally blown away by the band as the manager that we've just gone with was. And it's a genuine thing, and they know your backgrounds, and they really want to go for it, and everybody in that company wants to go for it.
Exactly.
Because it's hard these days, very hard. And you can't just go and go with some A&R guy, and yeah, you're signed, and yeah, here goes the record. It's not like that at all.
Yeah, that's true. Mick, another one of your excellent sessions, back in about 75, you became involved with Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review. How did that come about?
No, I just met him in the village one night, you know. I got thrown out of a club, you know.
Which I took him down to.
Which he took me down to.
Embarrassed the shit out of me.
I got slung out. I got slung out like three times. So anyway, in the end, like, I'm sort of hurling abuse from outside, you know. Threatening to come in through the window and everything, you know.
It was Colby, wasn't it? Paul Colby. It later turned out to be a good friend.
So the Dylan pick came up, and Dylan came up and said, well, just come with us for a drink, you know. So, and he says, well, He said, why don't you come out on the road with me for a bit? So I said, yeah, all right then. So, and that was it. I never heard from him. You know, 6 months later, it was like Friday afternoon, or something. The phone rang, and it was like, hello, ready to start rehearsal on a Sunday? You know, right. Yeah, you know, I suppose so. That was it, it was a quick rehearsal. Never played the same song twice. And he was out there and was on the road, you know. It was just like,
that's incredible, and it turned out to be a very historic tour. It really did. You met I don't know if you met him. It seems like you met a fellow by the name of T-Bone Burnett during that period of your life, and then you ended up a few years back opening for The Who with T-Bone. Do you have any plans of ever recording with him again? He's really doing some hot stuff lately himself.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen him for a while, you know.
He just put out an album just last year. I think it's called Talking Animals.
Yeah, Talking Animals.
Really good.
Yeah, there's some good stuff.
He's an interesting artist.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else can I talk to you about? Well, you've produced you produced Roger McGuinn's Cardiff Rose. How did you ever get involved with Roger McGuinn?
He was on the tour, you know.
Oh, he was on that tour?
Yeah, and he had, like, you know, his last commitment to do this album, you know, and the company was sort of pressuring at the time for him to get this album done. Well, you know, It was all right, but I mean, he had like four songs, you know, so it was like, he was in the studio there, and it was like trying to scramble all this sort of stuff together. And we both were sort of drinking a lot then, you know, to like that, you know, getting out there and partying, you know, and stuff, you know, and I mean, you know, some of the records are like not bad, you know, they're good, you know, that's
yeah.
sound, you know, it's all right. I think it could be better, you know. But, you know, a lot of things just happened really quickly, you know, around that time, you know. And, I don't know, that sort of period just flew by or something, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. You wrote a book in, what, about 75, was that?
Yeah.
Was that
No, it was before that. It was about 72, I think.
Was that Reflections of a Rockstar? Was that the name?
Yeah, whatever the fuck it was. I mean, I wanted to call it Sweepstakes because that's what it meant. That's what it was about. But I don't, you know, like Diary of a Rock and Roll Star.
They thought that was a great.
Yeah, which made me feel like a real dickhead, you know. I mean, then I was told, you know, that was what was going to sell the book, right? It was a bestseller for 2 years.
That's
a good book.
Yeah.
It is a good book.
I've been looking for a copy of it.
It's hard to find. Somebody told me they just re-released it.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if that's true. I saw a few of them around this time around. They're hard to get, though.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, now, do you still get royalties off of old Bowie records? Do you still get paid? Do you get money out of that stuff? Or is you don't get anything out of that? Because that stuff sells. You never got anything?
Yeah. Wait, they got fucked over.
Wait a minute. Was that because of the main man situation? Was that just a bad deal, or...?
He got fucked over.
Just a bad deal.
Oh, man.
Same with the Lou Reed stuff. You know, on the Wild Side.
Yeah. You were involved in the production of that, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Learn from it, that's all. That's all you can do. You learn from it, you know. There are experiences that can't be taken away from you just because you didn't get a few bobs. So what, you know? It's a pain in the ass, but there's a lot of people.
Would be nice, you know.
Because they still sold.
I know. Well, I sold royalty statements last year, the year before last, when I was in London, and I was looking through the royalty statements. Unbelievable. It's coming in.
The thing was, you see, there was no. I couldn't believe it when I found out, because De Vries was actually managing David and Mick. He wasn't managing the rest of the band. There was no fucking excuse for it. I mean, I could see him not paying the rest of the band for royalty. I could see that, but I understand that. But I mean, if you watch David at any other period apart from that period, I mean, it's clear what Mick was doing there, and he got ripped off, and he don't like talking about it, but I mean, that's a fact.
Yeah.
Well, David blames De Vries, and De Vries blames David, and you can't never get a straight answer out of any of them.
Right.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Well, they're both a pair of fucking arseholes, yeah.
But it's my own fault, you know what I mean? Because I was like, well, soft, you know.
Right. Yeah, but he was managing you. I don't see that you can say that, because it wasn't your own fault. I mean, have you got to get a lawyer to go against your own manager, you know what I mean?
Ian, here's a couple covers that people have done. I want to hear your opinion on them, or even if you, or how they happened. Barry Manilow covered Your Ships. How did that ever come about?
He went into... Clive Davis is always like my material, and Clive always keeps a bunch of stuff in his office. And Manilow went into the office, and Clive played Ships. And Manilow loves Ships because apparently something to do with his dad or something. And so he recorded
it
Ships.
How about Hanoi Rock doing Boulevard of Broken Dreams?
Yeah, that was pretty crazy, that was.
Yeah.
Bob Ezrin, you know, doing Hanoi Rocks.
Yeah.
Strange combination.
Now, that was pretty recent, huh?
I see Michael a lot.
Yeah.
But Michael's got a song I'm dying to get my hands on, and the minute he puts his record out, I'm going to copy it off his record. It's a great song.
Let's see.
I've been covered by a lot of people.
Can you think of any other off the top of your head?
Rudy Nelson, Point
Assistance. Yeah. Who did what? Willie Nelson was that?
He's done one called The Other Man.
Okay.
He's done it twice.
God,
still hasn't been released.
Really? It was never released.
He's got a lot of material that he hasn't released.
Were you aware that a UK documentary was in the works about you, and that the rumor was you were going to do a concert sequence to climax it?
Well, that was this guy Martin Hammett, right? The big underground producer, like Joy Division and all that. And I agreed to do it because it was him. But then they'd got a movie to do before then, which was about independent producers. So they spent their money doing this program about independent producers, which I think is a pretty boring subject. And they couldn't flog it. So then they couldn't get the money together to get mine on going, because they couldn't flog the one before, you know what I mean? And it was sad, because they'd already got one backer for mine. They'd got MTV Europe, but we didn't go in there, you know. I've never heard anything. You know, they rang me up and asked me would I do it, and I said yeah, you know. But that was last summer.
So nothing's really.
I didn't like the idea. You know, I wouldn't do it now, but I would have done it then. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was completely off the roll. I didn't know what to do. When you're that far off the roll, you know, you need a fluke. You need a bit of luck. You can't just go out looking to get going again. You know what I mean? I just figured I'm going to sit here, something's going to happen. So then I thought, well, maybe that's the thing that will start the roll off, you know. But now, I mean, the roll's been started in other ways, so really, it didn't appeal to me.
You, both of you, together have a legendary status, greater in the UK. There's people over there going crazy. They want to see you, and it doesn't seem like you've really toured over there a lot.
That's probably why.
They're dying for you. Is there any chance?
It was like the fucking
tour?
Second coming the last time we went there. Wasn't it? It's unbelievable.
There's a lot of people in England. I mean, if we went to England, then
we'd
sell out.
You should.
We'd sell out all these places.
Because they're going crazy over here. They want to hear you again.
Yeah, but we know that, so that's why we don't go. See.
Nice guys.
But we will go. No, we'll go.
Good. That's good.
We'll go when it's right. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
When we feel right. You know, when we feel like we can just walk into England.
Have you seen the recent UK anthologies of the CBS stuff along with the reissues of Mott?
No.
Supposedly that they're doing that, and you're getting reissued out there.
Well, it's good music. The music, I mean, I think the sounds and the speeds are kind of like a little bit duff, you know. Mm-hmm. But the songs still stand up.
Do you have rights to the Chrysalis recordings that you did? Do you still own that?
I don't own licensing. No, they own the licensing.
Really?
They're putting one out in 2 weeks.
That'll be on CD?
I guess so. I guess. What other reason would they do
it? Right.
It's really funny because they don't particularly like the new stuff, and the new stuff's about 10 times better than anything they could have put on their little CD in a couple of weeks.
There was a mention that you guys got along a lot better when you weren't touring. Have you guys kind of made amends as far as when you're touring that you look
we sat
at
down and had a little chat? Yeah. Yeah, one night. I mean, there was
I can see during a tour you're going to get tense anyway, so things are going to be a little different.
Well, both
than just
tend to get more than me. I mean,
yeah.
We get bored.
Yeah.
just our natures, both our natures, we get bored. I mean, this is like a great time for us because there's a challenge and there's a purpose and we know what we're going for.
Yeah.
I just hope neither one of us goes off it, because it feels so fucking good when you feel like this, you know. There's been times in the past too, there was like, you know, the first time we were together, he was with RCA, I was with CBS, he was with DeFreeze, I was with Fred Eller, and Fred Eller was whispering into my mouth I didn't need Mick, and DeFreeze was whispering into his mouth he didn't need me, and all this bullshit was going down. We've got rid of all that, you know. There's a lot of this outside stuff that we don't have to deal with now, that we had to deal with last time, which was didn't mean anything. Just people trying to justify their existence or something. So it's almost like we're coming back with a vengeance to make up for. But you got to understand something. He's produced a hell of a lot. I've got my own 16-track studio. I never used to be able to talk to him on a studio level like, but I can now. I went up and worked Canada 3 or 4 times over the last 3 years with a guy called Roy Young, who's an amazing singer. I learned about my voice. I think we're both better as players, and we know more, and we're older, and I think we'll be able to put up with each other more than we ever used to, you know.
That's great.
We was pretty young then, you know.
Yeah, you learn over the years, I guess.
Nobody's perfect.
No, that's true.
I mean, you do get bored with
everybody goes through it, you know.
You've been producing the Paolos for a few years now. Are you still working with them?
No, I produced their second and third album. The second album was the biggest, so it's the biggest one in there, so triple platinum plus.
How about PPL?
The last one I did, I think I went double platinum, and then they sort of like, then they had David Foster producing after that, which didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did one last year called Rock and Hide, that they wanted me to work on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted me to fly out to Vancouver, you know. But I never did it.
Mm-hmm. How about the PPL?
Right?
PPL? Is that the... I have a question here from somebody. They're just referring to three...
Pure Prairie League.
Yeah, Pure Prairie League. You've done some work with them,
Yeah,
right. Now, were you aware that the vocalist is now...
He's with Little Feet.
Little Feet, right. Yeah.
Right. Fuller.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right, so how did you get involved with Pure Prairie League? It seems like a little bit off base.
Well, that was like really early, you know. It's like when I was with David, you know, and... We was in New York. Me and David was in New York when the RCA deal was about to be, you know, come up. And then this guy Bob Ring, that's, you know, booking the whole tour and everything. That's how come I know Bob Ring, because Bob Ring was producing Pure Prairie.
Oh, okay.
And I got on really well with Bob, you know, and just sort of hang out with him and stuff, you know. And he says, look, he said, I really like what you do with arrangements and stuff. He said, will you, can I fly you up to Canada, you know, and this band with me? Band, you say, so I said, yeah, no, I think you're you know, so he flew me across, you know, to Toronto, you know, and I spent a couple of weeks or so, 2 or 3 weeks out there with them guys, you know.
You guys really have some real country roots, don't you? You guys are both of...
Well, a lot of country music.
Yeah,
I mean,
what kind of influences of the early, let's say some early country music, what kind of turned you guys on initially?
Well, I was always a Jerry Lee Lewis fanatic.
Oh, yeah.
And from there, I went on into and found out a lot about other people, you know. I think I was into it a lot longer. I mean, Mick only got into it basically later on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right from the off. To me, the birth of rock and roll was kind of Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis meeting in the bar one night, you know.
Right.
To me, that was it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there was more to it than that, you know.
R&B smashed into country music.
Chuck Berry had the lyrics, the Everly Brothers had the harmony, you know, like, and it all sort of wound up in the Beatles, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
Dwayne Eddy, I used to like him. I sat standing in the shop door with him, the guitar, pretending it was Dwayne Eddy.
Telephone kiosk, so,
yeah. Well, shop doorways were alright, because they used record, you know, with a stone floor and stuff.
Now, I've heard that Overnight Angels is your least favorite album that you've made. What?
It would be on a par with the last one I did, yeah. Those two.
Why did you look down on Overnight Angels? Because it's got some really good songs. Didn't have any meaning to it.
And the last one did, no. It didn't mean anything. That's where I was at. I didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of good songs if you want to talk songs.
Right.
But I much prefer it when we're doing things that mean something. You know? with something like the stuff we're doing now. It means something lyrically. Yeah. It's good. Yeah. It means something.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Five Night Angels was just kind of like a rock album or something, and the last one was just like a bunch of songs.
Was it short Back Inside that Mick Jones?
Yeah, that was
produced.
Interesting. That again, it wasn't me. I went on to disappear for about 5-6 years there, but that was interesting. It was real interesting. I didn't particularly like him, but I love the way he works. I mean, he loves freedom, you know what I mean? He likes to do anything, use anything, you know. If there's a radiator that sounds good, then the radiator goes on the record, you know what I mean? A bit like David that way, you know, he don't give a shit in the studio. I mean, anything.
I've heard something about you doing a movie or something at one time. Was that just rumors that were saying you were supposed to act in a movie or something like that? About the scene?
No, there's a couple of things.
The woman that
produced Eatin' Raoul was doing another movie, and it wasn't like Eatin' Raoul, which I happen to like a lot. But
good movie, yeah.
Yeah, but she went and she fought and she fought, and she'd seen the video to All the Good Ones Are Taken. So I was going to get this role, which apparently was the guy that was in All the Good Ones Are Taken. That's all she wanted. So I thought, fine, you know, that ain't going to be that hard to do, you know. And she ran around. She's a ballsy lady. She tried to get finance, and she couldn't get it, you know. I mean, we've both been offered lots of movies over the years. It just never seemed to materialise, you know. People can't get the finance or whatever, you know.
You guys got the faces and the personalities. I don't see why you haven't got into it.
Well, because they don't know how good we are, you know, basically.
Yeah. You guys have it, I think. What about how about the child's voice on Lisa Likes Rock and Roll? Is that your daughter?
Yeah.
And that was basically written.
I love Lisa.
Uh-huh.
I've always loved Lisa.
Yeah.
If anything ever happened to Mick or Susie, we would have had Lisa. Right?
Yeah. That's neat. I've discovered two different versions of "Roll Away the Stone." One with Mick Ralphs. Restrained playing, and the other with Ariel Benedict. Why did that happen? Why was there two different versions of that?
I don't know.
You don't know why? That's gone.
Just tell me anybody ever mentioned it.
Well, that'll go on in history as being another Ian Hunter question to ask sometime.
I know, we had Roll Away the Stone for the Mutt album, but then we thought, well, we've got a couple hits on the Mutt album. Why don't we old Roll Away the Stone, and then we know we've got it on the Pupil album, you know, and that'll start it off well, you know. That was the thing that was going on at the time. So maybe Mick Ralphs played the original solo, and then maybe Bender, you know, would, because he was now in the band, he would go in and do the same thing again. Uh-huh. You know, that may have happened.
How about what's your fondest memory of the Mott the Hoople days? What sticks in your mind the most? Or maybe it wasn't a fond memory, maybe it was a bad memory. But
I can remember, well, fondest memory was probably the, I don't know, I mean, I tend to remember the bad things about that band for some reason.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there were some great things. I mean, when it first rang me up, I said, you know, got the gig, you know. I mean, that was amazing to me because I never thought I'd ever get out of the factory. And then they said, but you know, you look real bad, you know. And I did look bad, you know. And they said, would you mind like if we took you around a few clothes shops and got you, would you grow your hair longer? And, you know, like you turned up at the rehearsal with shades, would you mind like wearing shades all the time, you know. And to me it was like, no, but to me it was like paradise. It was like they're that interested, they want to do all this.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I've got no money for clothes. And they said, well, we can get you £100 for clothes. Well, £100 then was like about $1,000 now. I mean, that was a lot of bread. And I was living on 15 quid a week with a wife and two kids in a two-room place in Archway. And it was like, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was like all my life I'd dreamed about stuff, you know. And they already had they were with Island Records and everything. So to me, that was probably one of the best times. Another one of the best times was when I left. Broadway was interesting.
What was that all about? You guys were one of the first rock bands to play Broadway.
We were the only band that ever played it.
Wow.
Before or since.
Yeah.
A few people played Radio City, which is not really classed as Broadway. It was great.
It was
Because it was like Croydon, you know, it was like that
Fairfield Hall in Croydon.
Yeah. I walked in there and I thought, yeah, we can play this place because we've done Fairfield a lot. And it was tremendous from the point of view. Fed Ella, like, was happening then. He set that whole thing up and it was like ABC, NBC, CBS, the whole stuff. I mean, it was like, first night, there wasn't a bloke under 60 in the place. I ran back in the dressing room. I said, these fucking people think this is a musical. This ain't for us, you know what I mean? It just didn't look like... And what it was they were all these invited VIPs and shit, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, the second night, everything kicked in. Like, the first night was just like, okay, are these the next big stars or what? You know, I mean, it's as simple as that.
How about you, Mick? Any fond or bad remembrances of... well, obviously, there was probably some bad ones from the old Bowie days and stuff like that. What you got any anecdote you want to tell us about?
No, I mean, I don't really have, you know, bad feelings about too much, you know. I had a good time, man.
Yeah. Those were interesting, yeah, they were interesting days.
Yeah.
I mean,
crazy days.
Yeah. Look at the style, the clothes styles that you guys, I mean, you guys started some trends, man.
So did Tony Curtis. I was talking to Tony Curtis about that.
Yeah.
He said that people got no style, and it's true, they don't. We're gonna show them some style again. We're just getting into it now.
All right, that's good to hear.
I'm fucking fed up waiting. I mean, it's like, all right, so we're in the 40s now, you know, and like maybe we should be like regular gentlemen or something. But it's also fucking boring. I'm just getting back into it, you know. Fuck it.
Well,
fuck them if they can't take a laugh, you know.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Because I'm sick of being dignified. You know what I mean? It's like it's just not happening. These gigs, people are bored at gigs, and they think that's rock and roll. That's not rock and roll. I went to gigs where I got blown clean out of my seat. That's rock and roll. Not watching the fucking Pet Shop Boys down a mall, you know what I mean?
Well, you've heard it here first. These guys are back on the scene and they're coming at it strong. This has been Mick Gray talking to Ian Hunter and Mick Ronson. Guys, do you have any last minute things you want to say to your new audiences out there, the new generations that are actually just learning who you guys really are?
No.
You guys...
Just tell them, you know, all they got to do is think for themselves. It's real easy.
Yeah.
Just because you're...
listen.
Just because the best kid in the class or the grooviest or the coolest person likes something, that doesn't mean you have to like it. You go and find out what you like, and that'll benefit you in the world. Because you'll grow up an individual and not an actor. Because 99% of the world are actors. They want to be a rock star, or they want to be a film star, or they want to be on the soap, they want to be somebody in a soap, or they want to be a baseball player. You know, all you've got's you. You be yourself. That's what people like. That's why they come and pay and see people like us.
All right. Well, I appreciate you guys letting me talk to you. It's been a great experience for me. And this has been Mick Gray for KSJS 90.7 FM.